This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. About a Boy, starring Hugh Grant, is a relatively small-budget Hollywood movie that has made a big impression. Last year, Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel called it the smartest, funniest, and most winsome big studio release of a so far dismal year, and the film earned Grant a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor. It's now out on video and DVD. Chris and Paul Weitz directed About a Boy, which they adapted from a novel of the same name by Nick Hornby, who also wrote High Fidelity. The Weitz brothers seem like an unlikely pair to take on this sophisticated comedy, since they were best known for directing the teen comedy American Pie. They also wrote the screenplay for the animated film Ants. Terry spoke with Chris and Paul Weitz last June. About a Boy stars Hugh Grant as a single guy living on the royalties of his late father's hit novelty Christmas song. He enjoys the uncommitted life, no job, no family, but he does like having relationships with women as long as they don't require a deep commitment. He's figured out that single mothers are easier to score with, so he pretends to be a single father, which is his ticket into a single parents group where he hopes to meet women. Here he is at a meeting, putting on his act.
I have a 2-year-old, Ned. He's got blue eyes and sort of sandy-coloured hair, and he's about 2'3". And his mum left.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously it was a very big shock because we were so happy, you know. Sandra's neurology practice was just up and running, and then one day her bags were packed and my best friend was waiting outside in his Ferrari. Yeah. You know, the moderner, the one with the supercharged engine where you can actually see the engine through the back window?
May I ask, does your ex see Ned at all?
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Susie.
Susie. She doesn't see much of him, no. Oh.
How does he cope with that?
You know, he's a very good little boy, very brave. They've got amazing resources, don't they? Mm-hmm. Just the other day, I was thinking about my ex, and he came crawling up and put his little pudgy arms around my neck, and he said, "You hang in there, Dad."
God, that's amazing for a 2-year-old.
Is it?
Yes.
Chris and Paul Weitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having us.
Is there anything that you related to about the scheme of this single guy to create an imaginary kid so he can make it with single mothers?
The fact that we've done that before.
We're method actors. We're method directors.
Well, I think that that every man at some point or other has come up with some cockamamie scheme to meet women, whether it be a haircut or a much larger kind of con. So I suppose I could sympathize with that, but more so with the character who essentially does nothing because he can afford to do nothing, and is trying to occupy his time on the way to the grave as entertainingly as possible.
I think that, I mean, in a larger sense, I certainly can identify with the idea that you pretend to be something before you actually are that thing. I mean, when we first were getting the chance to direct, and we had no idea what we were doing, and we actually didn't pretend all that much. We pretty much told people we didn't know what we were doing. But, and this is a guy who, he pretends to have a child, and during the course of the movie, actually finds that the one thing that he's pretty good at is being a mentor or a father figure. He's not particularly good at anything else.
Did you read this book when it was first published?
We didn't actually know it. It had already been published for 3 years by the time I got around to reading it, and I read it on vacation, and Paul and I had been looking for a book or a movie idea with a kind of Billy Wilder-esque theme to pursue, and I thought this was the one. Unfortunately, it had already been bought by Robert De Niro's production company, by New Line Studios, so it had been knocking around for a while before we came to it.
And there was another director attached, which was the unfortunate part, and there was another script. Which had changed the character to be an American living in London. We read it and we thought that Hugh Grant would be perfect for it because it's supposed to be somebody who's sort of gotten by on their charm through much of their life, and I think you can really believe that with Hugh. And it was also incredibly funny in a very verbal way, and Hugh's great at that kind of thing. So we just sort of hovered around like vultures until the project fell apart, actually.
And how did you convince the people you needed to convince, who I imagine included De Niro's production company and Nick Hornby, the author of the book, that you were the guy?
I don't know that we ever did convince Nick Hornby. So hopefully once he saw the film. Now, he's been very kind about the film. And I think that he feels like we were really true to the spirit of the book.
But I think that that both he and Hugh had their doubts about whether the directors of American Pie could make this this kind of book into the kind of movie that it is. I think they were so rabid about getting a chance to do it that eventually they just gave up on trying to put us off.
I mean,
I can understand that they would think that the directors of American Pie are the wrong guys to do this. So what did you do? I mean, did you show up and say, well, we made that movie and it did really well, but that's not who we really are?
Well, not really. I mean, just by being mildly articulate, you know, people are, you get a lot of credit. I mean, the lower the bar is in a certain way, it was as if they were dealing with a talking chimp, you know. the fact that we directed American Pie but, you know, had some degree of sensitivity. I mean, the thing is that our approach to American Pie was pretty much to try to make it as humanistic a telling of that genre piece as possible. We also stuck around. I mean, the project didn't get made for a little while, and I think that we could clearly articulate what we wanted it to be like. Which helped the studio get its head around it. I mean, we said we wanted to try to make a movie that is akin to The Apartment, which actually, I mean, the character in The Apartment has a similarly ludicrous scheme to get ahead, which is that he thinks he's going to get ahead in the corporate world by loaning his boss the keys to his flat so his boss can have affairs. You know, not a particularly wise, you know, way of climbing up the corporate ladder. But that's a movie that also has some really dark sort of things happening in the middle of a very funny comedy. So I think that if you're able to articulate the tone of what you're trying to do, then you're ahead of the game.
Nick Hornby's novels are filled with pop culture references. He wrote High Fidelity, and even in About a Boy, I mean, one of the ways in which the main character mentors the boy in his life is by giving him the right CDs and buying him the right sneakers, and it's just a lot of pop culture stuff. How did you find a visual language that you thought would work with the kind of pop style of Nick Hornby?
For one thing, when you're following Hugh at first, we shot it sort of like a very slick commercial, and the color tone is all blue. And when you're seeing the kid, this camera's fairly static, and there's a lot of sort of warm earth colors. I mean, the other thing
there's a distinction initially between the kinds of worlds in which these two people operate. In the first sequence, you never see Hugh's face. In the credit sequence, you just see things. We decided his apartment was very much about the things in it, so it's a lot of shots of very glossy, shiny objects that people might like to have. So when we do see him in the trappings of pop culture, it's often in a gigantic record store or
in the movie we tried to put him in as many sort of gigantic consumer venues as we possibly could. The other thing too is that when he buys the kid these sneakers, and then because the kid is dressed horribly by his mother and given a horrible haircut, he buys the kid these sort of cool sneakers. But, I mean, in the usual way you'd handle that, the kid would be transformed and there'd be some sort of, you know, musical montage where he's making the kid look cool. In this version, the kids at the next thing you see is the kid standing barefoot in the rain because the kids at his school have stolen the sneakers that Hugh Grant has given him. I think that going back also to The Apartment, there's this fantastic shot of Jack Lemmon at the insurance company where he works, surrounded by tons and tons of uniformed desks, which is actually, I think, a quote of a film called The Crowd, which is a great silent film about sort of the American dream. But nowadays, I think that, to intellectualize somewhat, we've gone from being a manufacturing culture to a consumer culture. So in this case, we were trying to put him in these sort of gigantic consumer venues that would depersonalize him.
Oh, I almost forgot. I bought some magazines. Do you want to just flip to the center section? Well, this is the female form, and they have focused on the breasts, which are used primarily to feed young infants, and also in foreplay.
Right.
This is Hustler. And this is a much more exotic magazine. Now, they have decided to focus more on the pubic region, the whole groin area.
Uh-huh.
Look at the expression on her face. You see that? See what she's doing? She's kind of looking right into your eyes, saying, "Hey, big boy. Hey, how you doing?" You see?
Right.
Now, this is a teen movie about several guys who kind of make this pact that they'll lose their virginity before college, hopefully by the time of the senior prom. And the movie is their adventures in virginity losing.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the kind of movie you felt like, yeah, this is it. This is what I really wanted?
To me, it was a very human contained story. To us, it was about what it was really about was guys going through a rite of passage, not the rite of passage of losing their virginity, but the rite of passage of graduating from high school. And they have this incredibly close friendship, and they all sort of know that they're not really going to be able to be that kind of friends anymore. So in order to not dwell on that, they become obsessed with losing their virginity. And also that what we were consciously trying to do was to make the film less misogynistic than most of the films of that genre tend to be.
Yeah, I think there were a few genre conventions that we had to satisfy. There have to be some breasts on display at some point or other, and people have to be caught in compromising positions. But that seemed to be the easy thing to do, all the gross-out humor. What felt harder was to portray a kind of updating of certain what had been stereotypes in teen sex comedies, and to realize that that a film like Porky's was in fact incredibly misogynistic and ugly, and to try to put women a bit more in control of the situations in this film.
I thought it was interesting. Most of the guys in American Pie are actually revealed to be very, very vulnerable, even though they're putting on this big front.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's a film where pretty much everybody is trying to be nice to each other. I agree.
But now I have to ask you about the actual title scene, the pie scene. Mm. And for listeners who haven't seen it, you know, a friend who claims to have lost his virginity says, when asked what it feels like, he compares it to the feeling of an apple pie. So the Jason Biggs character tests this out by getting intimate with a pie. And, of course, his father, played by Eugene Levy, walks in as this is happening. What went through your mind in considering how you should shoot that whole sequence?
Well, the first thing that we said to the studio was, look, you know, we're going to be very delicate. This is going to lose the comedy of this if you see too much. And then we got there and we said, you know, what the hell? Let's just shoot as much as we
can. It's not just what the hell. There's actually no way to show someone having
true.
Sex with a pie without showing someone having sex with a pie. I think to us the important thing was more the interaction between the kid and his father afterwards than the gag itself, which is fairly, you know, if you're willing to do that on film, then you've achieved the strength of that gross out gag. But the more important stuff is that his father is actually willing to cover up for him, and in some way is actually trying to deal with his son's what seems to him is perversion.
The film was interesting in terms of when it came out, because it actually came out right after the Columbine shootings, and so the Columbine shootings led to a huge questioning of the role of the R rating in society, and our film got sort of swept up in the question of, you know, should kids be allowed to go see films that are perhaps violent? So to me, the idea that America sweeps in sort of sexuality with violence and lumps them together in terms of how it deals with them in terms of its entertainment was interesting. And in retrospect, you know, the idea that, you know, that you have this image of American as apple pie, and so I thought there were a few interesting aspects to that being a central image of the film.
What were some of the issues surrounding, like, what kind of rating you wanted to get for the film?
Well, at first we had
an R.
We wanted an R.
Why did you want an R?
As opposed to an NC-17.
Oh, I see, right, yeah.
We knew that we'd never get a PG-13, just because...
Well, it's about virginity, so how are you going to do that?
Yeah.
It's about sex. But at the same time, we didn't want an NC-17, which is... If you haven't heard of it, it's because films that get an NC-17 rating never get seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rating above R, between R and X, and for about four cuts of the film, we were stuck in that kind of middle territory. And, you know, you get involved in these rather bizarre horse trading moments with the MPAA, in which you say, you know, well, I'll take out one F word if you give us this extra thrust on the pie. And so we went through a rather surreal period of watering down the film without watering it down too much.
Now, so, you know, your two best-known films are a teen comedy, a teen kind of like sex and gross-out comedy that is much more, I don't know, sensitive is the right word, than a lot of other films in that genre. Mm-hmm. And your other big film is About a Boy, which is mm-hmm. a much more kind of like sophisticated, witty story about adults. Compare for us how both of those films were tested and marketed before they were set forth into movie theaters.
The system for testing a film, any studio film, is the same nowadays. There's a research company called NRG, and they run a kind of market testing thing in which you invite what's supposed to be an arbitrarily selected audience to watch the film and grade it. And they have these cards on which they score the film in various ways and list their favorite scenes and the scenes they liked least and that sort of thing. You try as filmmakers to bias the selected audience as much towards your, you know, what you think is your hardcore demographic. So, of course, we only wanted teenagers to come to the American Pie test screening. I think we only wanted bourgeois mid-30s people to come to this one. And then you wait for this score, which is a kind of strange compilation of numbers, and on that score rests to some extent how avidly the studio is going to market your picture.
Luckily, they both tested really well. I mean, American Pie, you know, it was as if they'd had a religious experience or something. These kids, you know, they'd probably never seen a film before. I think filmmakers tend to fear those events, the test screenings. For us, we were a little lucky because there were a couple of really edgy, you know, comedic things in the film that the studio wasn't so sure would go over. But the test audience sort of singled a couple of those things out.
There were moments where Hugh Grant's character seemed to the studio to be on the verge of detestable, which audiences actually rather enjoyed. So we actually found ourselves benefiting from the process, whereas I think in certain cases it could damage a film, or at least damage the integrity of a film, mm-hmm. because you start catering to the imagined sympathies of an imagined audience.
American Pie, which you directed, it was one of the most popular teen comedies of the late 90s. What kind of teen movies did you grow up with? Did you go to the teen movies, or did you just watch, more?
We were watching Bergman in our teens.
Well, Strawberries is Hot.
I think, I was mostly about science fiction, Star Wars, the first Star Wars trilogy, which, of course, was in its own way was a teen movie. Luke Skywalker's kind of space teen. Although I guess less hormonal than Earth teens.
I remember going to see Porky's. I don't remember anything about it.
Did you like it?
As a kid, it didn't really stick with me, so maybe I didn't love it that much.
I liked it a lot at the time. I thought it was, you know, the Second Coming, but
the actors are all in their mid-30s playing 17-year-olds. I think I was frightened by it. But Fast Times at Ridgemont High is a wonderful film that deals from a female point of view with a lot of the issues and is a really funny comedy. And so I think that was more of an influence. And also Fast Times at Ridgemont High introduced a lot of wonderful young actors to the mainstream. So that was also something we were trying to do, was take unknowns and bring them to the fore.
Yeah, I remember seeing Fast Times at Ridgemont High and not understanding why the two cute girls holding surfboards in the ads weren't actually in the film. It was my first experience with disappointment with marketing, because they looked really great. That was a terrific film. Going back to Porky's now, I think, is a pretty mortifying experience, because the actors are in their late 30s to early 40s, have beer bellies, and are losing their hair, and also because the attitude towards women expressed in the script of that film is so odious.
I mean, just to go back to marketing About a Boy, I mean, the thing is, it's a little hard because people are now used to sort of classifying their comedies as romantic comedies, they're sort of teen genre comedies, but they don't really have that kind of category of films that, you know, for instance, Billy Wilder used to make. I mean, occasionally you get one like Jerry Maguire is a wonderful film, or As Good as It Gets. That actually manages to be a comedy for adults, but I think that it's a real trick to how to market that kind of film.
You're working together. It sounds like a mother's dream come true, you know. Every mother hopes that their children will actually get along when they become adults, but working together, that's great. Is your mother thrilled that you work together?
I think our parents are thrilled that we work, period, because it was touch and go there for a while. But yeah, they're pleased. It's the opposite of the old Cain and Abel scenario. But she doesn't get to see us in the editing room.
I want to ask you a little bit about your family. You come from a really interesting family. Your grandfather was an agent who represented Billy Wilder, who you referred to, and who else?
William Wyler, John Huston.
Ingmar Bergman.
Charles Bronson, oddly. And pretty much anybody who came into town with a funny accent had to stop at the Paul Kohner Agency and play gin rummy and have apple strudel or something. Our grandfather was, you know, had these great clients. Our grandmother was a Mexican film actress who starred in the first talking picture in Mexico.
And who's on a Mexican stamp, actually.
Wait, I read that she was in the Mexican version of Dracula?
She was, yes. It was shot on the same sets as the Todd Browning version, but from midnight on, after the English language crew had finished their day shooting. It was really a scheme by my grandfather to keep my grandmother in the country, because talking pictures had just come around, and she had an incredibly thick accent, and what with the end of the silent era, it looked like she wasn't going to get too many more jobs.
So he came up with this game of let's shoot Spanish language versions of American films at night when they're not using the sets.
That was his idea.
Yeah, as a ruse to keep my grandmother from going back to Mexico, Our mother, Susan Kohner, was an actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award in a film called Imitation of Life, which is an old Douglas Sirk tearjerker.
Where she plays an African, a very light-skinned African-American woman passing for white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our dad was a fashion designer in the 50s. He and I think Hardy Ames and Pierre Cardin, I'm probably leaving out a couple of people, were the first people to put their names on the clothing they were selling and to make it the whole idea of licensing and of the designer name.
But then he turned basically to writing biographies of prominent Nazis, because he had worked in intelligence in the OSS during the Second World War. So we've got a strange family, in other words, to cut a long story short.
So in your family, you had two actresses, an agent, a fashion designer. What was it like when you watched movies with your family? What would they point out to you? What were they looking for?
Really nothing. No. I mean, I think they all had their own predilections. My grandfather was still, I mean, my grandfather started out as a producer, so towards the end of his life in his 80s, he decided, I'm going to produce again. So he was really looking for properties to produce.
In his time, making films was an extension of a larger sense of being cultured, which had to do with literature. And, you know, a lot of the great films of his time were made from books.
I think that actually our mother instilled more of a love of the theater. And maybe on our part, as opposed to, I think, most directors who come from a very visual perspective and maybe come up through doing MTV videos or commercials or something, we, like the old filmmakers of the 40s and 30s, were really looking to theater and to the written word a lot more for our inspiration.
What were your teenage years like? Maybe you can compare your teenage years to the teenage years in American Pie. The issues are going to the prom and losing your virginity.
I was in high school in London. There was no such thing as a prom. I wore my school had been in mourning for Queen Victoria for about 100 years. So the uniform was black and gray and white. It was a very different scenario. I don't think I met a girl until I was about 18, and I played a lot of rugby and cricket. Similar to American Pie.
So do you know what kind of film you will be doing next or that you would like to do next?
Not really. It's going to have to be ambitious, and that I think that could either be ambitious on the level of just being truthful, or ambitious on the level of scope the visual tasks set before us.
I mean, I think that, well, I've certainly decided that the process of making a film is so incredibly draining that you may as well overreach yourself slightly. Otherwise, you're sort of wasting your time. The last thing we want to do is another version of what we've just done. I can never understand the position of a sort of jobbing director. And fortunately, we don't have to be, because we can kind of write to keep body and soul together while we're waiting for the next thing to direct. So it's really hard to say exactly what. I only know it would be interesting if it were some kind of leap in genres. It would be amazing to do a science fiction film or a thriller. I think the only thing we wouldn't do is an action film, since I think there are enough things blowing up in real life without blowing them up on screen.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.